1973 in review. Through the worldwide facilities of United Press International and the UPI Audio Network, you're about to hear the voices of newsmen and newsmakers, the dramatic sounds of the events that are part of the historical record of the year 1973. What kind of year was 1973? It was a year that drastically changed the lives of men.
It is my belief that while the president was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate the implications of his involvement.
After hard deliberation and much prayer, I concluded that the public interest would best be served by my stepping down.
I am Elizabeth Anderson.
Take the Mark Antony Peter.
1973 was a year that altered the course of governments.
There is artillery fire on the Suez Canal, the Egyptian front, and air activity over the Golan Heights.
The fighting in the streets was extremely intense. It was for 6 hours in the downtown Santiago was a inferno.
So far, there's no word on the fate of Papadopoulos, except tanks and troops are ringing the center of Athens, where the presidential palace is located.
It was a year that affected the common man.
I am asking tonight that all gasoline filling stations close down their pumps between 9 p.m. Saturday night and midnight Sunday every weekend.
Instead of asking for a rollback of prices, he suggested a ceiling on prices, which is just a great way to neutralize everyone except all these people who are on the warpath.
The ship opened up three, I don't know what you'd call them, subjects emerged from the ship, came, took them by the arm, and they said they seemed to float. They didn't walk or run or anything. There was a humming inside the ship, and that there were all types of instruments of types that he had never seen before.
For some, 1973 was a new beginning.
It is a very touching moment here as these prisoners come out of the plane, the first 40 men back from North Vietnam.
For others, it was the end of a lifetime.
Not long ago, President Johnson brought me here to this very spot. And he said, Billy, one day, you're going to be asked to preach my funeral. You'll come right here under this tree, and I'll be buried right there. History will never be able to ignore Lyndon Baines Johnson.
But whatever your social status, your political persuasion, or economic rank, in some way, large or small, the year 1973 had to have a profound effect on your life. One of the promises President Nixon made when he took office for the first time in 1969 was that he would try his best to end the war in Vietnam. Peace talks that had been broken off in 1972 started again in January. Henry Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho were the chief negotiators for the two sides. Finally, the rumor that had persisted during the last part of 1972 became a fait accompli in 1973.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia.
Ironically, the announcement came on the very day that former President Lyndon Johnson passed away. It was the Vietnam War that troubled Johnson so, and it was the war that influenced his decision not to run for a second term. The agreement called for the withdrawal of the remaining 23,000 American troops from Vietnam and the release of all prisoners of war. For many Americans, there were emotional reunions of families who had been separated, some for as many as 8 years. The first batch of POWs arrived at Clark Air Force Base on February 12th. The first man off the plane was Navy Captain Jeremiah Denton, Jr.
We are profoundly grateful to our Commander-in-Chief and to our nation for this day. God bless America.
For their efforts, Henry Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Kissinger donated his prize money, some $60,000, to help the orphan children of American servicemen. Lê Duc Tho refused the prize. The actual signing of the agreement came on January 27th. It was in Paris, and Chris Lodge was there.
Outside the majestic hotel, under leaden skies that threatened to explode into thunderstorms, hundreds of demonstrators gathered, waving North Vietnamese and Viet Cong flags. The first delegation to arrive was the South Vietnamese, headed by the foreign minister, Tran Van Lam. The demonstrators almost drowned him out as he read a prepared statement thanking the French government for hosting the talks. Chris Lodge, Paris.
In many cities in the United States, church bells were rung at the exact time of the signing, symbolic of the peace that everyone had waited so long for. However, the promised ceasefire in Laos and Cambodia didn't come immediately in 1973. American planes took part in bombings until August 15th, when a congressional ruling took effect halting the bombing. Some 300 members of AIM, the American Indian Movement, demanding the government start a full-scale investigation of government treatment of Indians, seized a trading post and a church at historic Wounded Knee in South Dakota. 11 persons were taken hostage on the Oglala Sioux Reservation. AIM leader Russell Means announced the Oglala tribe's position.
We do consider ourselves under attack and at war with the United States of America, and we are asking that all concerned freedom-loving countries of the world aid us in our struggle for independence.
Negotiations continued for over 2 months. During that time, the hostages were freed, hostilities reached the point of gunfire exchange, and as a result, one FBI agent and an Indian were shot. It all came to an end in May when both sides agreed to meet on the reservation to discuss the Indian charges. Another famous battle took place during 1973. It didn't take place on your regular battlefield, but rather on a tennis court. It was the Battle of the Sexes. 55-year-old Bobby Riggs, former tennis pro, bon vivant, and modern-day hustler, challenged women pro tennis players to a match. He bragged that a flabby, fading 55-year-old man could beat any woman tennis player, even the best. He was right once and wrong once. In the first match against Australian pro Margaret Court, Riggs won in straight sets, seemingly out-psyching Court with those high-arching lob shots which seemed to throw her off balance. American lady pro Billie Jean King took up the next challenge, and in a carnival atmosphere in the Houston Astrodome before a nationally televised audience, Billie Jean demolished Riggs with the same flair he had handled Margaret Court, straight sets. At the end of the match, Billie Jean seemed more pleased over helping the game of tennis than in beating the top-seeded male chauvinist.
I love tennis very much. I wanted it changed ever since I started in the sport. I thought it was just for the rich and just for the white. And ever since that day when I was 11 years old and I wasn't allowed in a photo because I wasn't wearing a tennis skirt, I knew then that I wanted to change the sport. And tonight, a lot of non-tennis people saw tennis for the first time. I don't even care what kind of match it was.
As for Riggs, well, what could he say?
I would say Billie was too good. I played my game. She didn't let me play any better. She was on top of me. She handled my serve beautifully, and she followed her serve up really well, hit her overheads well, and volleyed extremely well.
It was a story of the highest intrigue and complexity. It told of political espionage, burglary, big money payoffs, and telephone bugging. Its cryptic jargon included words such as gemstone and plumbers. It was a story the world came to know as the Watergate Affair. In January, when 7 men were found guilty of breaking in and bugging the Democratic National Headquarters, few people thought there was more to the story. But the presiding judge on the trial, U.S. District Chief John Sirica, thought differently. He suggested further investigation. A Senate committee was formed, headed by Sam Ervin of North Carolina, and then a bombshell hit. Convicted defendant James McCord wrote a letter to the court. In it, he said he was under political pressure to plead guilty. He implicated high government officials, including former Attorney General John Mitchell. President Nixon started his own investigation, and his press secretary, Ron Ziegler, called all the previous White House statements on Watergate inoperative. Demands for an explanation from the president grew more insistent as winter turned to spring. The press, politicians, and the people wanted answers. Finally, on April the 30th, President Nixon addressed the nation.
The easiest course would be for me to blame those to whom I delegated the responsibility to run the campaign. But that would be a cowardly thing to do. I will not place the blame on subordinates, on people whose zeal exceeded their judgment, and who may have done wrong in a cause they deeply believe to be right. In any organization, the man at the top must bear the responsibility. That responsibility, therefore, belongs here. In this office, I accept it.
But that wasn't all. In that same speech, an indication of how involved Watergate might be became apparent when Nixon announced these resignations.
In one of the most difficult decisions of my presidency, I accepted the resignations of two of my closest associates in the White House, Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, two of the finest public servants it has been my privilege to know. because Attorney General Kleindienst, though a distinguished public servant, my personal friend for 20 years, with no personal involvement whatever in this matter, has been a close personal and professional associate of some of those who are involved in this case, he and I both felt that it was also necessary to name a new Attorney General. The counsel to the President, John Dean, has also resigned.
The CIA and federal investigators reported that attempts were made to cover up the Watergate affair by high-ranking members of the White House. So the stage was set. The nationally broadcast Senate Watergate hearings replaced soapbox operas as the daily fare for housewife viewers. In his testimony, former counsel to the President, John Dean, started with a prepared six-hour document in which he asserted the President joined in the Watergate cover-up plot.
It is my honest belief that while the President was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate at any time the implications of his involvement. And I think that when the facts come out, I hope the President is forgiven.
John Mitchell, who headed the Nixon campaign committee until shortly after the Watergate burglary, was questioned by Senator Ervin.
Did you at any time tell the President anything you knew about the White House horrors?
No, sir, I did not.
Did the President at any time ask you what you knew about Watergate?
Not after that first discussion that we had on the telephone, I believe it was on June 20th.
Well, if the cat hadn't had any more curiosity than that, they'd still be enjoying his nine lives, all of them.
Well, I hope the President enjoys eight more.
But it was Alexander Butterfield, former White House aide, whose testimony opened up a whole new aspect to the hearings. He was asked by Minority Counsel Fred Thompson.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date. My guess, Mr. Thompson, is that the installation was made between, and this is a very rough guess, April or May of 1970 and perhaps the end of the summer or early fall 1970.
If there were tapes made of conversations which took place in the White House, the Senate committee surmised those tapes could be used to clear up some of the contradictory testimony. So they requested the President deliver certain tapes to them, and so did Archibald Cox, the man picked by the President to be the special Watergate prosecutor. Citing the separation of power and executive privilege, Nixon refused both requests. The committee then subpoenaed the tapes, and so did Cox.
This afternoon, I received from the White House a letter declining to furnish the eight requested tapes. Careful study before requesting the tapes convinced me that any blanket claim of privilege to withhold this evidence from the grand jury is without legal foundation. It therefore becomes my duty promptly to seek subpoenas and other available legal procedures for obtaining the evidence for the grand jury. The effort to obtain these tapes and other documentary evidence is the impartial pursuit of justice according to law.
The insistence of Nixon and the persistence of Cox led finally to a high noon showdown on October the 20th. Cox was fired. Attorney General Elliot Richardson quit rather than fire Cox, and Richardson's deputy, William Ruckelshaus, was fired because he too wouldn't dismiss Cox. It was quite a day, and it caused an unusual ventilation of public outrage. A few days later, Nixon relented and said he would give up the tapes. 1 week later, however, the court was informed that two of the requested tapes, one of Nixon and Dean and the other of Nixon and Mitchell, did not exist. But the saga of the tapes did not stop there. Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods, said she accidentally hit the record button while transcribing one of the tapes, and this error may have resulted in part of an 18-minute gap on one of the tapes, 18 minutes of buzz and hum. White House lawyer Fred Buzhardt was questioned by reporters about the tape.
When did the President learn that this tone was on the tape, sir?
I don't know precisely.
Well, why didn't he, for instance, say so at his news conference the other day?
I don't think he understood that it was, at that time, that it was on a subpoenaed conversation.
There were no further bombshells to come. Why didn't the President say...
I don't think this is a bombshell.
This doesn't seem important to you, Mr.
Senator? It seems very important. Probably be, I don't know how construed. We thought we ought to make a report to the court after having reviewed these. We reviewed them all.
The Watergate investigation did not end in 1973. What it brings in 1974 can only be speculated. But its effect on many people in 1973 was summarized succinctly by a member of the president's own party, Senator Lowell Weicker of Connecticut.
It's what all of us do from here that will give to Watergate its meaning. All of us almost allowed America to be taken away from us. And it's going to take all of us to keep it.
It was the afternoon of October the 6th, the Jewish holy day of atonement, Yom Kippur. Jews throughout the world were observing this sacred day of religious commitment. But in Israel, the day was shattered by the news that war between the Jews and Arabs once again had begun. Most heard the news over a radio program which was interrupted.
Shalom Kavit.
Shalom Kavit. A Hebrew code phrase which was a signal for troops to prepare for war. Abba Iban, Israeli foreign minister, speaking at the United Nations, accused the Arabs of starting the fourth war in the 25 years of Israeli independence.
The governments of Egypt and Syria simultaneously and together have performed two acts so base and vile that it is hard to find words adequate to their infamy. The first act is an act of treacherous aggression. The second, perhaps more heinous, is the crime of mendacity.
Israel was determined to hold the territory which it had won in the 1967 Six-Day War. The Jewish strategy was to make an all-out effort to regain the positions it had lost at the Suez Canal and the Golan Heights, the two places where the war had started. As in the 67 war, the United Nations and the two world powers, the United States and Russia, immediately responded to the conflict. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger went to Moscow to confer with Soviet party leader Leonid Brezhnev, and the UN Security Council sponsored a resolution calling for a ceasefire. It was reported the resolution came about as a direct result of the Kissinger-Brezhnev talks. The Arabs and Jews accepted the ceasefire, but the international community was startled when the United States placed its military forces on a worldwide precautionary alert.
We obtained information which led us to believe that the Soviet Union was planning to send a very substantial force into the Mideast, a military force. When I received that information, I ordered shortly after midnight on Thursday morning an alert for all American forces around the world. This was a precautionary alert. The purpose of that was to indicate to the Soviet Union that we could not accept any unilateral move on their part to move military forces into the Mideast.
A United Nations peacekeeping force was sent to the trouble spot, and peace talks were scheduled before the year was through. Acts of terror, kidnappings, plane hijackings, and bombings were also part of 1973, and many of them were a direct offshoot of the Mideast tensions. The tragedy of the conflict in Northern Ireland made itself felt in places other than Belfast in 1973. There were bombings in London and speculation that the IRA was responsible for some of them. Pat Thurgood reports.
I'm in fact at Old Bailey Road. The ambulances are pulling in and leaving just as quickly as they can. An ambulance has just left from the Old Bailey Road, and a motorcycle policeman right behind it, all set to pull in front and escort it through the downtown traffic here in London. There have been at least three that have gone off so far. This would coincide with the one that was dismantled by the bomb experts from Scotland Yard this morning. It was set to go off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon London time. Two more went off just about right at that time. One in the Agricultural Department area of Whitehall, which is within half a block of the seat of government in this country. And this one at the Old Bailey, the law courts, totally demolished most of the street. The buildings stand, but there isn't one pane of glass left in any of the windows. Certainly not at the Old Bailey itself, the law court building.
6 months later, a worker for the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. was opening the morning mail. One of the envelopes was a letter bomb.
She was very seriously injured. She lost a hand, and the other hand is very badly damaged, and she is at the moment receiving surgery in one of the local Washington hospitals.
After 3 years of a pro-Marxist government headed by Salvador Allende, Chilean military leaders took over. The coup d'etat was preceded by months of unrest with student protests and union-instigated strikes. The coup was a bloody one in which the presidential palace was bombed and shelled. UPI offices in the capital city of Santiago are only a block away from the scene, and correspondent Steve Yolen kept vigil during the takeover. When it was over, he reported.
The fighting in the streets was extremely intense. It was for 6 hours. In the downtown Santiago was a inferno. It was just as bad, was worse than it can be described. For me, it was 6 hours of pure terror, basically because we were being shot at. In matter of fact, the reason we were being shot at is because the troops were worried about snipers, and we found out yesterday that 12 snipers were taken out of the building in which our offices are located. The main newsroom took about 150 bullets. The radio photo reception site took about 20 shots. Two went right through the radio photo receiver. It looks very interesting. The opposite wall of the newsroom from where the windows are, it can best be described as looking like the craters of the moon because of the bullet impacts, just craters all over it.
In another South American country, the first election since 1965 took place. When they were over, Dr. Hector Campora was the new president of Argentina. Campora was the hand-picked candidate of Juan Perón, who had been barred from Argentina since his government was overthrown in 1955. But in 1973, Perón returned to his homeland. There was scattered violence during the parades held for Perón. Shortly after he arrived, Campora resigned, new elections were held, and Perón captured 62% of the vote. His running mate was his wife, an ex-cabaret dancer, and the first woman vice president in South America. It was 1967 when a young Greek army officer led a coup d'etat and became premier of Greece. That man, George Papadopoulos, tried to strengthen his position in 1973 when he proclaimed Greece a republic and made himself president. Papadopoulos made promises to his people. Parliamentary elections by the end of 1974, political prisoners would be freed. Well, that was in June. In November, the Papadopoulos government was overthrown. Chris Lodge reports from Athens.
The Greek proclamation, all is calm. Martial music and the second military coup in 5 years is underway. President George Papadopoulos is out, reportedly under house arrest, and a new military commander, a little-known Greek general, is in. But for the American and British tourists stranded in their hotels, there is little interest. A 24-hour curfew has been slapped on Athens, but as I toured the hotels, many tourists were basking on hotel sunroofs under a warm Athens sun. Some were playing Scrabble or just loafing it in the bar. There appears no apprehension and no panic. Another revolution, one Briton asked me, well, I've been through five. This one even seems tame. He left the sunroof for the safety of the hotel bar. Chris Lodge, Athens.
And so went the fame and fortunes of just a few of the countries of the world.
We've heard of black power, we've heard of Indian power, we've heard of green power, we've heard of woman power. Let's leave here and show the country and the Cost of Living Council what pump power is.
The summer of 73 made many Americans realize that the fuel shortage was a real thing. The man you just heard was protesting that many independent gas stations had to close down on weekends or at least limit their sales of gasoline during the summer months. Some station owners charge as much as $1 for a gallon of gas. But before winter set in, things had gotten worse. The president asked all gas stations to close down on Sundays. The situation became critical because of the Mideast war. Arab nations announced a monthly reduction by 5% of the petroleum they would ship to countries known to be friendly with Israel.
Because of that war, most of the Middle Eastern oil producers have reduced overall production and cut off their shipments of oil to the United States. By the end of this month, more than 2 million barrels a day of oil we expected to import into the United States will no longer be available. We must therefore face up to a very stark fact. We are heading toward the most acute shortages of energy since World War II. Our supply of petroleum this winter will be at least 10% short of our anticipated demands, and it could fall short by as much as 17%.
In some countries, like the Netherlands, driving was banned completely on Sundays. While driving was not banned in the United States, the president did request highway speeds be lowered.
Consistent with safety and economic considerations, I am also asking governors to take steps to reduce highway speed limits to 50 miles per hour. This action alone, if it is adopted on a nationwide basis, could save over 200,000 barrels of oil a day, just reducing the speed limit to 50 miles per hour.
And the president made one more suggestion that would affect everyone who uses oil for heat, if they complied with him.
To be sure that there is enough oil to go around for the entire winter, all over the country, it will be essential for all of us to live and work in lower temperatures. We must ask everyone to lower the thermostat in your home by at least 6 degrees, so that we can achieve a national daytime average of 68 degrees. Incidentally, my doctor tells me that in a temperature of 66 to 68 degrees, you're really more healthy than when it's 75 to 78, if that's any comfort.
The fuel shortage, which started in 1973, was only half of the energy crisis story. Blackouts and brownouts were a definite possibility if people didn't conserve electricity. The president appealed to everyone to turn off lights or electrical appliances when they weren't needed. Many cities announced they would curtail their Christmas decorations, and Congress voted that the country return to daylight savings time during the winter months. The old adage about people complaining about the weather but never doing anything about it didn't hold true for the price of meat in 1973. When meat prices began to soar early in the year, a meatless week was proclaimed by people all across the country.
We are all going to boycott meat as for as long as we can and for as much as we can during the month of April, meaning that some of us will continue to not buy meat at all throughout the entire month, and others are going to limit severely their consumption of red meat. And we're going to continue this not just through April, but until we accomplish the goal.
The meat industry felt the impact of a week-long boycott, but prices continued to rise until President Nixon made this announcement.
I am ordering a freeze on prices. This freeze will hold prices at levels no higher than those charged during the first 8 days of June. It will cover all prices paid by consumers. The only prices not covered will be those of unprocessed agricultural processed products at the farm levels and rents. Wages, interest, and dividend will remain under their present control systems during the freeze.
While the prices held during the freeze, some people still looked for other ways to relieve their pocketbooks. Some turned to eating dog food as a protest against the prices, and an isolated few said they were supplementing their meat diet with plain old horse meat. In the face of the rapidly snowballing international monetary crisis, the U.S. moved to devalue the dollar by 10% in 1973. The administration said the devaluation would be a benefit to the nation and its workers and businesses. The move was made to give the United States more equilibrium in international accounts. John Wilson, senior vice president of the Chase Manhattan Bank, explained how the devaluation would affect the United States.
Devaluation ought to improve U.S. exports, but again, only over some period of time. For some imports coming into this country, there will be an increase in the price. It will mean higher costs as far as the American traveling abroad is concerned in those areas where an exchange rate change has occurred.
Despite the gloom domestically, internationally the United States took strides to improve relations with the two giants of the communist world, China and Russia. Party leader Leonid Brezhnev visited the United States for summit talks with President Nixon. 9 agreements were signed during his stay in June. In the most important agreement, Nixon and Brezhnev agreed to try to avert military confrontation which might lead to a nuclear war between Russia and the United States or a third country. They both agreed to accelerate the SALT talks and complete a new arms limitation treaty by the end of 1974. On his last day in the United States, Brezhnev cited what had been accomplished by his trip.
We came to this country anticipating that these would be responsible negotiations devoted to major questions bearing on the development of Soviet-American relations and to a search for ways in which our two nations could promote the further invigoration of the entire international atmosphere. Today, I have every reason to say that those hopes were justified. Let me say frankly that personally, I'm also pleased that this visit has given me an opportunity to gain some first-hand impressions of America, to see some aspect of the American way of life.
Henry Kissinger replaced William Rogers as Secretary of State during the year. But because of his role as National Security Advisor, many thought Kissinger assumed the role of the Secretary even before he was officially appointed. It was Kissinger who negotiated the Vietnam Peace Agreement, and it was Kissinger who traveled to Peking before he was Secretary of State to set up a liaison office between China and the United States.
It was decided that the existing channel in Paris was inadequate, and that, therefore, each side would establish a liaison office in the capital of the other, and in henceforth it will be possible for the United States and the People's Republic of China to deal with each other in the capital of the other.
The United States launched its first orbiting space station during 1973. During the year, three manned Skylab missions were performed, and the space endurance records were broken on each succeeding flight. Skylab 1 started out amidst a flurry of technical problems. The unmanned space station got off the ground okay, but its solar-powered wings failed to open up. When the manned crew got to the space station, they performed repair work and attached a makeshift sunshield.
I'll tell you where we are. We got the wing out locked. The outboard panel and the middle panel are about half the same amount. And the third one is not quite. Now, Joe, I think before you come in, you better take a look up there and make sure that third one is clearing all the debris. Everybody's bugging me. All right?
The first manned Skylab mission set an endurance record of 28 days and 40 minutes in space. But more importantly, the astronauts proved that man could work in space for prolonged periods of time without any apparent damage to their physical well-being. The second manned Skylab crew had company aboard their ship. They had 1,000 vinegar gnat pupae, flies, 50 minnow eggs, 2 minnows, 6 pocket mice, and 2 spiders named Arabella and Anita. Just about everything but a partridge in a pear tree. They performed experiments with the spiders, and overall the menagerie fared quite well. That is, all except the spiders, who didn't care for the insects they were scheduled to eat. But ground control had an answer to that dilemma.
Tonight after your meal, when you have filet mignon, we would appreciate it if you would share a small piece of red or pink meat about the size of a housefly with both Arabella and Anita. When Arabella is stationary in her cage, carefully place her piece near her legs and carefully place Anita's portion in her vowel. Over.
Okay, we'll do just that. And, of course, you'll want to take proper account of this in our daily tallies or caloric intake for the SBT, but certainly won't mind sharing a couple of housefly-sized pieces of my filet with Anita, especially since she has had a very large horizon at this point, as well as with Arabella.
For the astronauts, whose 59 and a half days in space, traveling 26 million miles, set a new endurance record, the highlight of the trip seemed to be an extraordinary spectacle of the sun. Because of an explosion on the other side of the sun, it blew a bubble about three-quarters of its own size. On another occasion, the astronauts saw the biggest and the brightest solar flare of the year.
The flare in progress is also classified as X1, but it appears to be bigger than anything we've seen to date in the program. Over.
Yeah, we agree with you 100% up here. It's the Big Daddy. Oh, it's even talking about Aurora, for God's sake.
Borealis or Australis?
Simultaneously.
Skylab 3, scheduled down in 1974, will set still another endurance record. What lies beyond the solar system is a question man may never know the answer to. Other worlds, other people, or new mysteries, all are possible. A spaceship called Pioneer 10 will be the first man-made object to journey beyond the solar system into new areas of the unknown. Pioneer 10 made a 22-month, 620 million-mile journey to the planet Venus. It arrived at its closest point to the planet, 81,000 miles away, in 1973. Close-up pictures and data will have scientists busy for months trying to solve even more of the mysteries of space. And who knows? Someday in its journey, Pioneer 10 may be sighted by other people on another planet. And they may call their local sheriff and report seeing a UFO. That's what two men from Pascagoula, Mississippi did, but their story was more incredible. They said they not only saw the UFO, but were brought aboard the ship by the creatures who flew it.
I was carried to the vehicle, and inside I didn't touch anything. I was didn't have any sensation whatsoever. And inside it was just a bright glowing light. I didn't see any light fixtures of any kind. It just glowed inside. And then they left me for I don't know how long, and I was just helpless. And then I don't know how long I was in there. And once outside, I was immediately put back on the ground. And I wasn't harmed any way that I know of that I'm... And that's about the way it happened.
UFO sightings were quite prominent in 1973. Even the governor of Ohio said he followed a UFO down a Michigan highway. Well, for those of us who didn't get to see the little green men from outer space, there was Kohoutek. Kohoutek, called the Christmas Comet, more spectacular than Halley's Comet in 1910, passed within 75 million miles of the Earth. And if you didn't see it in 1973, don't hold your breath till next time. It won't be back for a million years. For the British, 1973 is less likely to be remembered because of Kohoutek than for the wedding of the Queen's daughter, Princess Anne. Dick Growald reports from London.
Well, the Empire is dead. Ireland's in flames. They're issuing gasoline ration books across from Westminster Abbey. Britain is up to here in debt, and the power supply is running out, and taxes and... Well, by George, so what? Well, Princess Anne is getting married, so the champagne is flowing in the Connaught. The Rolls Royces and the double-deck red buses are rolling in the Loyalists. Across Westminster Bridge. All the Queen's men and all the Queen's horses are out in their finery, and the pubs are filled with toasting and, well, former Prime Minister Harold Wilson says Britain doesn't rule a wave. Ah, well, but Anne's getting married in the morning.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth. I'm Miss Louise.
Take thee, Mark Antony Peter.
Take thee, Mark Antony Peter.
To my wedded husband.
To my wedded husband.
To have and to hold.
To have and to hold.
From this day forward.
From this day forward.
For better, for worse.
For better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
For richer, for poorer.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
To love, cherish, and to obey.
To love, cherish, and to obey.
Till death us do part.
Till death us do part.
According to God's holy ordinance.
According to God's holy ordinance.
And thereto I give thee my trust.
And there, too, I give you my truth.
Like a fairy tale come true, the son of a sausage maker married a princess. Mark Phillips and Princess Anne were married in Westminster Abbey, where the ceremonies were televised and beamed by satellite all over the world. The commoner met his wife of regal background when he was horseback riding, which turned out to be Princess Anne's favorite hobby. The queen, like most mothers, cried at her daughter's wedding. But don't be misled to believing that all marriages in Britain are as beautiful as Princess Anne's. Spectacular, maybe, but beautiful? Well, let Pat Theragood tell the story of a young British lass who got married on the very same day.
In what must be the understatement of the year, a local paper reports that guests were surprised at the goings-on during a wedding ceremony of Miss Bindi Shah to Mr. Hakim Nid. She smacked her almost father-in-law with a whiskey bottle and fractured his skull, butted her fiancé's maiden aunt in the stomach with her head, and locked her own mother in the church bathroom. Then she ran into the street, drove off in her fiancé's car, crashed it a short distance away, and vanished in the ensuing crowd. The only comment from the bridegroom was that it was the first time she'd ever expressed any emotion towards him.
I, Richard Nixon, do solemnly swear.
I, Richard Nixon, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
For Richard Milhouse Nixon, 1973 couldn't have started better. He was inaugurated for his second term in office, and in his inauguration speech, he hinted that peace in Vietnam was almost a reality.
Because of America's bold initiatives, 1972 will be long remembered as the year of the greatest progress since the end of World War II toward a lasting peace in the world.
But as the year progressed and his administration became surrounded by the Watergate affair, his critics became more harsh. Nixon's known antagonism for the press was augmented in 1973.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting in 27 years of public life. I'm not blaming anybody for that. Perhaps what happened is that what we did brought it about, and therefore the media decided that they would have to take that particular line.
It was the television media that especially irked the president during the year, and when one TV reporter asked him why he was angry at the press, he said,
"Don't get the impression that you arouse my anger."
You see, I can have that impression.
You see, one can only be angry with those he respects. When a commentator takes a bit of news and then, with knowledge of what the facts are, distorts it viciously, I have no respect for that individual.
During the year, President Nixon was asked to explain a lot of things regarding his finances. He admitted he only paid about $1,600 in taxes during two of the years he was president. He said he'd received tax benefits as a result of donating his vice presidential papers to the National Archives. They were, according to Nixon, valued at $500,000. Then there was the criticism of how much money he had spent to repair and renovate his homes in Key Biscayne, Florida, and in San Clemente, California. The involvement of two very close friends, B.B. Rebozo and Robert Alpelin Alp, with the financial and real estate affairs of Nixon also came under fire. There was also a charge that Nixon sought and got special favors for the IT&T company. IT&T was being brought to court by the government on an antitrust case, but Nixon answered his critics and stood his ground.
I made my mistakes, but in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination, because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
At the end of the year, Nixon made available figures which showed he tripled his net worth during his first 5 years in office. The report revealed Nixon was a millionaire. But it was the revelations of Watergate and Nixon's actions, and in some cases his inactions, which led many congressmen to call for his resignation or impeachment. The first Republican senator to favor the resignation of Nixon was Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts. During the so-called Operation Candor with Republican congressional leaders at the White House, Brooke told the president straight out that he should resign. When he left the White House, Brooke was asked what the president's reaction or response was.
He was very gracious. He said he understood that my statement was not made with malice. He understood it, the reasoning that I gave for it, but he thought that that would be the easy way out. He was not going to accept that suggestion.
Although Nixon's popularity dropped to an all-time low, according to some public opinion polls, many people still supported him. Spiro Agnew did become a household word. Now it seems it's a name that will never be forgotten in the annals of American political history. Spiro Agnew, the son of a Greek immigrant who achieved the glory of becoming vice president of the United States, fell as fast as he rose to fame. When he first learned of the investigation which said he received contract kickbacks, Agnew was angry, and his famous tongue lashed out at his detractors. But 11 days later, Agnew pleaded no contest to a charge that he falsified his income tax return, was fined $10,000, put on 3 years probation, and resigned his office.
I take leave of you tonight, my friends, in that same sober but trusting spirit. God does reign. I thank him for the opportunity of serving you in high office, and I know that he will continue to care for this country in the future as he has done so well in the past. The government at Washington does live. It lives in the pages of our Constitution and in the hearts of our citizens, and there it will always be safe. Thank you, good night, and farewell.
Now it was up to Nixon to find a successor to Agnew. 2 days after Agnew's resignation, Nixon made public his choice.
He is a man who has served for 25 years in the House of Representatives with great distinction.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties of the office.
The duties of the office.
On which I am about to enter.
Of the office on which I'm about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Together, we have made history here today. For the first time, we have carried out the commands of the 25th Amendment. In exactly 8 weeks, we have demonstrated to the world that our great republic stands solid, stands strong upon the bedrock of the Constitution.
The kind of year was 1973. It was a year of war and peace, a year of victory and defeat, a year of crisis and resolution, agony and joy. It was a year in which each one of us may have learned something to help us through 1974. And it was a year that gave more credence to the biblical passage from Ecclesiastes, which says, "In time, all things will come to pass." You've been listening to 1973 in Review, a presentation of the United Press International Audio Network. This program was written and produced by Stan Sabick. Researcher was Debbie Floor. Technical supervision by Frank Shortino. I'm Ed Cairns.